All right, so we're here to talk about the Song of Songs, right? Which is next to Leviticus, maybe one of the most avoided books in all of the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible. It's certainly one of the most curious. It's one of the, I think, one of the most interesting. In my field at OC, I teach the books commonly known as wisdom literature, and so this figures very prominently in my teaching. And the more I study it, the more I am intrigued by it. And so what I want to do in this session today and tomorrow is to help us think about how we hear this text, right? Because texts are like people, right? They often reveal more than we think they do. And just like, I don't know, it's sort of like that time when you're a child and you go up into your attic, into your grandmother's attic or your grandfather's attic, and all of a sudden you have this epiphany that, wow, they're human beings. You know, that day when you realize your parents are actually people, and that they have thoughts and feelings and, you know, sometimes it's like, you know, too much information. The Bible is kind of like that, too. And the more that we get into these stories, we think, really, this is in here? And well, what is this doing in here? And wow, this is our sacred text, but yet it's doing things that I don't expect. Right. So what do we do with all of that? So I want us to, I'm going to present today kind of a landscape of how the song has been heard and invite you to listen to it perhaps in a way that you haven't thought of before. So a lot of the things I'm going to talk about today are things that have to do with the way the song is put together and what it might be saying to us. Right? So will be some things for reflection, and we'll continue that tomorrow. So, as we open today, there are some questions, right? How do we hear the song? And the first thing is to realize kind of what's in front of us, is that it is a song, right? It's a piece of poetry. And you know from the playlist that you have on your phones and in your cars that you listen to your own songs for different reasons, right? There's things about certain songs that you like. There's things about songs that you don't like. There's things that speak to you that don't speak to other people. But that's the whole point of a song or poetry. It invites emotional connection, right? And it invites experience, right? You know what it's like if you've ever been through either a great coming together with somebody or a breakup, right? You listen to friendship songs and breakup songs, right? And that's how we process life a lot of times, is through music, right? And through poetry. And so we have to remember when we're looking at a piece like the Song of Songs, which is how it's defined in the very first verse, that this is poetry, this is art, it's highly imaged, and it invites us to approach it in that way. It's different than prose. It's not law, right? It's not Leviticus. It's not don't do this, do this. It's a poem. It's a song, right? So we have to remember that. The second thing is the question about, does this song constitute wisdom? Now, our tradition has always said yes, right? The way it's brought together, the five scrolls that you've heard about, and also the way it's generally cataloged in our in a lot of our Sunday school curriculum and just kind of our Christian tradition, it's lumped in with Proverbs and Ecclesiastes and Job and Psalms, right? It's one of those pieces of wisdom. And one of the questions in the academy, and by that I mean the kind of the watering hole of biblical scholars, right? Everybody gets together and talks about text, is this a piece of wisdom literature or not? Or is this simply a genre all of its own? Is this a piece of erotic poetry that's akin to the Egyptian love poems of the ancient Near East or other texts that are parallel? Or is it some combination of both? right? And if it is a piece of wisdom, how does it function as wisdom, right? What about the song gives us that sense that this is wisdom or not, right? This is a question I often put on my final exam for my wisdom class. Is the song a piece of wisdom? And if so, explain how, right? Or if you don't think it is, back that up. Explain why not, right? And so if it is, right, what is the wisdom about love, right? That's something we want to look at, particularly in this class. And if it is wisdom about love, then can it be a cautionary tale, which is often what wisdom does, right? It raises questions that ask us to think about life. It gives us deeper insight into how we relate to one another in a love setting. But as is often true with Hebrew Bible texts, there's a lot more going on under the surface than may be obvious. And so the song, with all of its images, and I'll show you some of those in a minute, it's actually, I think, perhaps suggesting that we look a little bit deeper into this aspect of wisdom. So today and tomorrow, we're going to actually pick up on this thread of wisdom and see what the song may have for us. We're going to sort of gradually move into the text, but I want to do it through sort of, raising some questions for you to be thinking about. There's several, in the landscape of this research on this poem over the centuries, and both in Jewish tradition, Christian tradition, there's the question of, is this a collection of single poems, or is this a unified poem, right? And this is something that's debated back and forth. There are a lot of people that see the song as a collection of different love poems that are kind of strung together. There are other people who see it more as a single unit, right? No matter how you see that, the reality is that in our canon of Scripture, we have it as a flow of eight chapters, right? It starts and it ends. So we have to, as a piece of literature, as a poem, we have to reckon with how it works in our text as a single piece, right? So how does it work? What's it doing? And the next question is, how many voices are we hearing? Right, now, this is something where your translation and also the form of the song on the page, depending on what Bible you're reading, is going to lead you in some different directions. Right? This is one of those books where there's a lot of interpretation done by the formatting of the book. Right? So it's going to, for example, maybe talk to you about, okay, this is when the sort of the group of bridesmaids are speaking. This is the groom. This is the woman, right? Or this is a group of singers. I mean, it's going to split all that up for you, which, of course, is not part of the text at all. So we have to kind of think about, how is this poem working in terms of voices? For example, is this simply a dream sequence, right? Is this a single sort of flow of consciousness from the woman who is imagining her beloved, right? The way this is written, it talks about erotic love. It talks about kissing and acts of intimacy, but it talks about them with a certain distance, which may lead us to think that this is something that a woman is imagining, right? Or is this actually a play? Could this be enacted, right, where you actually have players, right? Last year, there was a choral group that came through Oklahoma City. I didn't know this group, but they had were actually singing the song in its entirety as an oratorio, They had put it to music, and they had broken it up into characters. They had composed original music to it, and they performed the entire song, it was in English, as if it were a musical. The thing about it that was so intriguing was the music kind of sounded like a cross between a Christmas song and Andrew Lloyd Webber. I mean, it was really schmaltzy. And I thought, this doesn't work, does it? The music just didn't quite work with the song. I mean, it was beautiful, but it made me hear it in kind of a different way. And it raised this question about voicing, right? And what voices are we hearing? So we have to think about that. And then we have this very intriguing question about what does Solomon have to do with any of this, right? The beginning line, chapter 1, verse 1, the Song of Songs that is Solomon. And we have references to the king, we have references to Solomon, regal images that come through with Solomon, and we have to figure out what is his role in all of this. Now, the thing that is a bit problematic about this is kind of one of those things that hides in plain sight, right? Because one of the first questions that comes to mind when we think about Solomon, of course we think about wisdom, right? But how did Solomon's life end? Not well, right? This is a very Hebrew Bible thing. Things typically don't end well, right? But what else do we know about Solomon, right? What does he do with women? He collects them. And so, if this is a poem about a man and a woman, which it is, then what does Solomon do to that? Right? Does this in any way make this poem problematic in some way? A lot of people have read this song as Solomon as being the male, right? He's the one that is the beloved. But there's some other ways of approaching this that could tell us something maybe a little different or perhaps darker, right? But again, we have to sort all this out, right? And there's lots of different ways to do that. So one of the things that people have talked about and is why write this in the first place? This is always a question that whenever you come to a text, we always ask, why is this text here? Right, of all the things that could have been written, why this? Right. So some of the things that are out there, it's a courting song, it's a wedding song, which is very common. It's this is sort of one of my favorites. It's a piece of love magic. You know, it's like an amulet. You know, it's red, it's thought to have magical effects. I don't quite know how we would support that, but anyway, there's people that like to go there. Is it an Egyptian-like religious love poem about? Or is it a mortuary song about love and death? Or is it just simply a diversion of the heart? Can it just be a song that entertains and celebrates love, right? This is kind of where my son and daughter are really fun to be with because they have these very different views of how things should be. My son will go theological almost immediately with something. And my daughter's like, why does it have to be complicated? Why can't it just be fun? Why do we have to be, you know, can't it just be, you know, and she'll hear somebody go off on a 30-minute, you know, thing about some complicated verse in Romans or Genesis, and her response is, okay, how does this help me deal with a patient who's on dialysis? Right? She's an ideal social worker. So, but I think we have to recognize that too, right? Can it just be what it is? Does it have to be complicated, right? There's actually nothing in the text that demands that it be read as an allegory, We've done that throughout the centuries, both Jewish and Christian readings. But there's nothing in the text that demands that, other than the fact that it's poetry, and poetry is typically allegorical. But we can just let it be what it is. So I put these options here as a way of opening up your own thoughts, our own thought processes, so that you can think about as you read it, kind of what you think it might, what it might be. How has this been read? Before we get into our reading of it, how has this been interpreted? I realize this is small. Now, Doug is going to go through this a lot more when he talks about the preaching element. So I'm just going to mention these briefly. But in the early wisdom traditions, these are primarily Jewish, it's the importance of understanding the bond of love, physical and spiritual, between a man and a woman. Right? That's the kind of the simple, straightforward reading, which was probably the earliest reading of it. The first early Jewish allegorical traditions expressed mutual love between God and Israel. Right? We would maybe kind of expect that. Kabbalistic traditions talk about the harmony between the human and the divine. Christian tradition, Hippolytus was the first one to kind of propose the relationship between Christ and the church. The Messianic traditions, relationship between the coming Messiah and the people. And then, of course, more and more, we're coming sort of back to where we started, which is the love poem, celebrating love between a man and a woman. But this this text has inspired so many different ways of reading, which makes it such a fascinating text to study. And there's many more kind of in between here. I did want to show you one which gets referenced quite a bit. Bernard of Clairvaux wrote these beautiful, beautiful sermons on the Song of Songs. And this is, we're not going to spend a lot of time on this, but I want to bring it up because he has some very beautiful thoughts about love, and this kind of gets back to thinking about it as wisdom. Love is alone sufficient by itself. It pleases by itself and for its own sake. It is itself a merit, and itself is its own recompense. It seeks neither cause nor consequences beyond itself. It is its own fruit, its own object and usefulness. I love because I love. I love that I may love. Love, then, is a great reality and very precious, provided that it recurs to the principle on which it resets, that it is kept in continual relationship with Him who is its origin, and draws from that pure source waters that flow continually in greater abundance. When God loves us, He desires nothing else than to be loved, because He loves us that He may be loved by us, knowing that those who love Him become blessed by their love itself. Right? It's really gorgeous. Right? You can meditate on this all day long. Right? But this is the kind of work historically that's been done on the song, as really unpacking love for the beautiful thing that it is in and of itself. Right? And this is something that is that makes the song worthy of approaching it as a wisdom text, mainly because of the text itself and all of this really beautiful writing that's been done on it. Again, in the slides, if you're interested, I have several other quotes by different writers of that sort of era. Gregory of Nyssa has also done some really wonderful work on that as well. But I want to get into thinking about a particular refrain that comes up in the song that may be a clue as to what it also may be doing in addition to all of this. I'm going to give you an outline of kind of what happens, right? And this is just sort of taking the different sections of it.
Which is
songs. There you go. See, there you go. Thank you. Songs, which is songs.
Whose voice was that?
I don't know, divine. It's all part of the mystique. Right? Kabbalah has descended upon us. So kind of as you go through, there's a declaration for the beloved. The woman speaks, then there's a male voice that comes in, there's a dream. And then right about here, there's this entry of Solomon on his palanquin, right? Which is, you can picture Solomon riding in on the, you know, the little seat that's carried by poles, right? It's royalty. So he comes into the midst of the picture right about chapter 5. There's another dream of the beloved. There's some friends that question about what makes the beloved special. The woman replies. And you've got some more discussion there. There's praise for the woman's attributes. The declarations of love again, right? It kind of goes back and forth. And then there's this really curious statement in 8, at the end of 8. But what shall we do for our little sister? All right, I'm going to get to that a little bit more in a minute. But it's one of those images that shifts on you right at the end, that it's like, well, why is that there? Why are we talking about our little sister? Right? And then it moves on to some reflections about being chosen by Solomon, and then a final plea for the beloved to come, and actually with a hint of rescue at the very last verse. Now, we're going to go through some of these in a little bit more detail, but I wanted to show you something very interesting that happens in the middle of this sequence, right? There is a stick. Yes.
Go on the reference. The second reference. I'm confused on it.
This one here?
Yeah, 3:3:5. No, up there at the top.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's 3:5.
Okay.
It should be 3:5. I'm sorry. Yeah, you can fix that. In those three sections, there is this statement, right? Do not awaken love before its time. And it comes back three times. That's 2:7, 3:5, and 8:4. Right? And this is where we get a hint that the song may be trying to tell us something about the nature of love. Right? And typically when something is repeated like this in a poem, it means we need to pay attention to it. Right? It's said at the introduction. It's said again towards the end. And it's repeated again after kind of the dream of the beloved in 3. So it comes back three times. And so what might account for this? One of the things that we noticed, if you'll notice in chapter 1, verse 4, we'll start the Song of Songs, which is Solomon. I'm beginning at the chapter 1, verse 1. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine. Your anointing oils are fragrant. Your name is perfume poured out, therefore the maidens love you. Draw me after you, let us make haste. The king has brought me into his chambers. Right. We will exult and rejoice in you. We will extol your love more than wine. Rightly do they love you. Right. So the way this starts out, you have a reference to Solomon. You have this idea of the woman who's imagining the love with her beloved, but then you have this statement that the king has brought me into his chambers. Now, again, reflecting on who Solomon is and what he does, could this be a woman who is deeply in love with a man, but she has also been chosen to be in the king's entourage? Mm. And so, therefore, she is not only imagining and reflecting on the love that she has for her beloved, but she is also imagining that he will rescue her from essentially the captivity of the king. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, we might not get this were it not for the direct reference to the king in Solomon. And the other thing that that makes us wonder a little bit about what may be happening is that as she continues to reflect at the end of chapter 2, before she talks about the attributes of her beloved, she says, in this image, oh, that his left hand were under my head, that his right hand would embrace me, and it's a very erotic image. But then she says, right after that, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the wild does, do not stir up or awaken love until it is ready. Right? Now that's it's the juxtaposition of this very graphic and very beautiful image of two people holding each other in a very intimate type of embrace. But then it's interesting to think about, so why is there a caution right after that? Right? Why are these things paired like this? And it sort of makes us wonder, I think, do not stir up or awaken love before it's ready or before it's the time of pleasure is here. The same thing happens here and at the end. So one of the things I'd like for us to think about is, as we look at the description of the beauty of the woman, right? Now this happens in chapter 5. What kind of images are these? Right. In chapter 4, in chapter 4 and also in 7, let's go there. Right. We have Solomon that enters, verse 6 of chapter 3 actually starts us on that. What is that coming up from the wilderness like a column of smoke perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all the fragrant powders of the merchant? Look, it's the litter of Solomon. Around it are 60 mighty men of Israel, all equipped with swords, expert in war, each with his sword at his thigh, because the alarms by night. King Solomon made himself a palanquin from the wood of Lebanon. He made its posts of silver, its back of gold, its seat of purple. Its interior was inlaid with love. Daughters of Jerusalem, again, the ones who are cautioned at the end of chapter 2, come out. Look, O daughters of Zion, at King Solomon, at the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, on the day of the gladness of heart. Right? And so now you have this first, in 4, what follows is a description of the woman. And very possibly, since we've just been reading about Solomon, it would be Solomon's description of her. Again, this gets into how we read the dialogue and read the characters, but I wanted you to notice in particular the physical descriptions. Flock of goats, pomegranates, Tower of David, shields of warriors, Lebanon, valuable spices. What do all these sound like? Tower of David? I mean, these are all things you possess. Right? If you have a flock of goats, ewes, and gazelles, again, it has something to do with possession. You're really going to compare the beauty of a woman to a flock of goats? I mean, you see what I'm saying? I mean, yeah. These images are striking in terms of who might be saying them, right? Tower of David, this is all male warrior possession property kind of images, right? He's describing the woman in terms of what he would possess, right?
So like a conquest?
Yeah, kind of as a conquest type of thing. So if we're thinking about the woman being described in terms of something to be conquered or something to be possessed, right, then even though if this is, in fact, in 4, if this is Solomon's description of this woman that he loves, and there's no denying that he may love her, but it's tainted with this language of possession, right? So when we think about the phrase, "I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, do not awaken love before its time," right? Could this be telling us that, you know, I'm going to put it kind of in common language, it's like, ladies, don't put yourself out there too soon. You know, because you may be very, very beautiful, but if you put yourself out there, you may attract the king's attention, and that may not be something you want. Hmm. It also can be read the other way, which is don't allow yourself to fall for somebody before you're ready. Now, see what I'm saying? Don't awaken love before it's time. It's don't awaken it in yourself. Don't allow yourself to go too soon. And don't do things that arouse the other person. Because guess what? Once love is out of the bag, it's out of the bag. Mm. Now, we all know from experience that you don't get to pick when you fall in love. I mean, we can try. We do all that online all the time, right? You know, all these dating services, everyone's looking for love. But we all know the fact that there's something about love and chemistry that's pretty unpredictable, right? And once it's there, then it's, you can't just opt out without being hurt. So, as a wisdom piece, is part of the wisdom here really cautioning us, in a good way, about recognizing the power of attraction and the power of love? And is the song saying, be really careful? Because this is powerful stuff, right? This is not to be toyed with. This is not to be flirted with. This is not to be treated promiscuously. This is not a light thing. This is heavy stuff. And in the society in which the song could have been written, we can let it be the song, you know, even between, you know, a man and a woman and all the attraction, we can let it be that. We can let it, we can let Solomon be in there. But I think what's the entrance of Solomon into all of this raises the stakes on how beauty actually can work. And so when we come to the end, and I'm going a little bit fast because I want to be conscious of our time here, but I want you to take a look at the end, and we're going to talk about 8, verse 6 and 7 tomorrow. This was one of the sections that last night in Dr. Marr's address to us. He set me a seal upon your heart, 6 and 7. We're going to concentrate on that specifically tomorrow. But right after that comes this curious verse. We have a little sister, and she has no breasts. What shall we do for our sister on the day when she is spoken for? Right. So the way this ends suggests we're, you know, as women in the song, we're all targets. You know, Solomon could be wanting to annex any one of us. And so what shall we do for our little sister who's not of age yet? At the end, verse 11, Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Haman. He entrusted the vineyard to his keepers. Each one was to bring for it its fruit, 1,000 pieces of silver, Verse 12, my vineyard, my very own, is for myself. Right? I mean, the woman is very conscious of reclaiming her own sovereignty over her own body. And you, O Solomon, may have the thousand or the keepers of the fruit of 200. O you who dwell in the gardens, my companions are listening for your voice. Let me hear it. And then verse 14, make haste, my beloved, be like a gazelle or a young stag upon the mountain of spices. That phrase, make haste, may be part of what she is actually dreaming or thinking. It's like the one she truly loves, come rescue me. I don't want the fate of being part of 700 concubines. Mm-hmm. Right? I want to be with my beloved, the one that I truly love. The king has spoken for me. How do I get out of this? So, you know, again, thinking about it as wisdom, or a cautionary tale, it's speaking to us about love, yes, but it's also speaking to us about this power of love that is very hard to control. And it's very difficult once it's out of the bag to reel it back in, and the consequences can be really significant. Right? So don't awaken it before it's time. That will preach, actually, I think. So I'm going to let Doug have the next, just to say what you're going to say here, and
right.
Then,
right.
Again, tomorrow we'll pick up here, and we're going to spend more time in chapter 8, but
Dr. Ricks is going to kind of handle the first two sessions primarily today and tomorrow, and then I'll kind of take the lead on the third one. Talks a little more about preaching from the song. I want to tell you about my first experience with the Song of Songs. It was during a sermon, but it was not in a sermon. Eighth grade, Holiday Church of Christ, church my dad preached and ministered in that church for 20 years. Youth group sat sometimes up front, sometimes in the back. It was one of those Sunday nights, and we were in the back. And my dad is a great minister, a fine preacher, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful man, my hero. But I have to admit to you that sometimes Sunday nights were hard for me. I praise the Lord that I now preach at a church where I meet with a group of people around a grill in a living room on Sunday nights, and that's a good thing for me and for the people that we're talking to. Tom, my best man eventually in our wedding, my insurance agent now, he and I are in the back row, both of us fairly good students. We've heard whatever Dad's preaching before. And so we have these things in our church in Holiday, Texas, called pew Bibles, right? And so I pull out the pew Bible, and I begin to read the Bible. I mean, it beats doing other stuff on Sunday nights, like passing notes, right? It beats sleeping. And so I'm reading the pew Bible, and I get to what I called Song of Solomon, but I noticed my Bible called it Song of Songs. And I thought, I didn't even know that was in the Bible. Song about songs. And in the eighth grade, I discovered the Song of Songs during a sermon, but it wasn't what Dad was preaching in the sermon. Okay? And I began to read Song of Songs. And I elbowed Tom and said, dude, check this out. And that was my adolescent introduction to the Song of Songs during a sermon. I talked to Dad, who's now preaches twice a month in small churches around, serves as an elder, and he's pushing 80. I said, Dad, when's the last time you preached in Song of Songs? And he just laughed at me. And he said, well, I've referred to it many times. I said, well, Dad, did you ever really? Well, once or twice through years, I was doing one of those, preach through the books of the Old Testament on a Sunday night, you know, 39 weeks. Make room for children's home directors and fundraisers from Christian colleges and other places on a Sunday night. You get as many of those as you can to do that on Sunday nights. But in a year, you could cover all 39 And Dad said, a couple of times I did that, and I said, well, how'd you do it? And Dad said, well, I kind of just would point out how it's been read. And I would say, is this really about God in Israel? Is this really about God, Christ, and the church? Or is it something else? And I said, well, where'd you come down, Dad? And he said, well, I just kind of hurried through and gave the nod to Brother Larry. Brother Larry was our song leader. And I said, well, so you didn't do much with it? And he said, not really, not really. And then he said, that's what Cope has you talking about out of Pepperdine, isn't it? I said, yeah, he owes me. And so Dr. Ricks, Charles and I are blessed to talk to you about the Song of Songs, the greatest song, the song of all songs, in a sense. And I'm going to tell you, I began to do some research, and Charles is a wonderful Hebrew Bible theologian, a PhD in Hebrew Bible. I am not, okay? I'm a preacher, and so I rely heavily on people like Dr. Ricks. And so I began to go to my library that I've invested thousands and thousands of dollars in through the years. And so I get to Walter Brueggemann, and he has a book called Reverberations of Faith, and it's a theological thematic study of the Old Testament. And so I quickly, 256 pages to be exact, and I start whipping through Reverberations of Faith. One reference only to the Song of Songs. In his chapter on sexuality, the very last phrase is, as I quote, I've timed out. Without a scripture reference, or without a quote, here's what he says. Bernard of Clairvaux probed deepest in this theological drama of love in the Song of Solomon. That's all he said. He dropped it. So next on my shelf is Walter Kaiser's book, a little different kind of theologian, but a person cares about the Bible. Hard texts of the Old Testament. And I think, well, surely I can get some good stuff from there. And so I go through hard texts of the Old Testament. I read through the table of contents, and, well, there's nothing there. But maybe, so I go back to the back and the references where all the scriptures are listed. Preachers who preach know how to find those information. You want to read the whole book. You just want to find the part that applies to what you're talking about on Sunday or Pepperdine. And so I did that. And guess what? Goose egg. Hard text of the Old Testament? Not going to touch it. Now, fortunately, I had the second volume, more hard text of the Old Testament. That's literally the name of it. Walter Kaiser, you look it up. And there was one text. He dealt with one text under more hard text. And when you're forced into doing a second volume, your publisher makes you do that. You have to do things you didn't want to do the first time around. You have to do that. So I thought, well, that's not helpful at all. And so then I thought, well, I need to go to my homiletic resources now, not just some Old Testament resources. So I go to Tom Law, a man I respect greatly. I use his book, The Witness of Preaching. Dave, I'm sure you've used that one, the Harding grad. And so I go through Preaching the Literary Forms of the Bible. Guess what Dr. Long devotes to the Song of Songs? Basically nothing. Basically nothing. Now, he could, and I'm sure he has somewhere, but in that book, he didn't. And so then I grab my next book that I consider a step down from that one on literary forms of the Bible, and they didn't touch it either. I went to a third, and there was a reference that says, you might could call it poetry, you might could call it wisdom, but then they didn't call it out after that at all, and they left it. And so, I want to tell you, in most of our libraries, there's not a lot there to help us. Mm-hmm. You can preach for 25 years in churches large and small. You can talk to people in seminars and lectureships and accumulate the library that is quite adequate for that and not have very much to work with. And so, that's one of the issues I'm going to be dealing with. I have to hurry. I thought it was very appropriate that my document that I saved as an abbreviation, I put SOS, Song of Songs. Okay. As a preacher, though, it was kind of a 911 call to preaching. My time's up. I'm just briefly trying to whet your appetite for what are we going to do with this eventually. We'll talk a little bit more about that tomorrow, and then we'll spend most of our time on Friday morning about that. Charles, anything?
Yeah, again, if you're interested in the slides or the handouts that we have, if you want to sign up for that, we will send those to you electronically. And hopefully we'll see you tomorrow. We will continue.